We spend so much of our time, I think, just obsessing over single numbers.
Oh, absolutely.
The unemployment rate, the inflation number, the price of, I don't know, Bitcoin, my cholesterol level.
Right.
But when you really stop and think about it, the world doesn't actually work in single numbers, does it?
No, it really doesn't. Nothing happens in a vacuum. A single number is, well, it's just a dot on a page. It doesn't tell you the story.
Exactly. Life is messy. It's a web. It's about how this thing pushes on that thing. Does studying more actually get me a better grade? Does eating more kale actually make me live longer?
Probably not.
And that is exactly what we're diving into today. We are looking at the math of relationships.
We are. And to be really specific for our listeners who are, using this as a study aid, we are doing a comprehensive deep dive into Chapter 5 of Analysis of Economics Data. This chapter is all about bivariate data summary.
Bivariate, which is a fancy word for two variables.
Precisely. We are moving from looking at just one thing at a time univariate analysis to looking at two things together. We have our $6, which we usually call the independent or the explanatory variable, and then we have our yard dollar, the dependent variable,
The outcome.
the outcome. And the mission today is to figure out, well, how do we summarize the relationship between them?
And we aren't just going to talk about feelings here or intuition. We need to answer some really hard questions. How do we measure that connection? Can we, draw a line through it? And maybe most importantly, how much do we trust that line?
Those are the three pillars. First, measuring the association. Second, summarizing the relationship mathematically, and that's usually with a line. And third, assessing the strength of that relationship.
Okay, so we've got a lot of ground to cover. We're going
Right.
to walk through two-way tabulations, scatter plots, covariance, correlation,
And the big one.
the big one, the boss of introductory econometrics, linear regression, and its trusty sidekick, two-hour tutus.
And we are going to anchor all this abstract theory, to a very specific real-world data set from the text. We're going to the suburbs.
That's right, the house data set. So let's set the scene for everyone. We're in Central Davis. The year is 1999,
A simpler time.
a simpler time, and we have data on 29 houses that were sold.
And it's a good data set because it's a fairly homogeneous market. We aren't mixing Manhattan penthouses with, say, farmhouses in Iowa. It gives us a controlled environment to look at our two main variables.
Which are?
Sale price, which is our outcome, our Yala variable, and house size in square feet, which is our explanatory variable, our $6.
Okay, so just to give you the lay of the land, the prices for these 29 houses range from about $204,000 to $375,000. And the sizes run from 1,400 to 3,300 square feet.
Right.
Now, intuitively, if I ask anyone on the street, what happens to the price of a house when it gets bigger? They're going to look at me like I'm an idiot.
Because the answer is obvious, right? Bigger houses cost more.
Right. But obvious isn't economics. We need to quantify it. We need to know how much more. So let's start where the chapter starts, organizing and visualizing the data. Step one is usually just, staring at the list of numbers, right?
It is. And with only 29 houses, you can sort of do that. You
Yeah.
can run your finger down the size column and then look across to the price column. And you'll see a pattern. Generally, as the size numbers get bigger, the price numbers get bigger. But that's not scientific. We need a method.
So the first method in the toolkit is the two-way tabulation. Sometimes it's called a crosstab. Now, I'm used to seeing these for categories, like you have rows for men and women and columns for smoker and non-smoker. That's easy. But we have continuous numbers here, price and size. You can't make a table with a row for every single possible dollar amount. I mean, the table will be a mile long.
Exactly. So before you can tabulate this kind of data, you have to categorize. You have to take that continuous data and, well, chop it into bins.
Bins, okay, buckets.
Buckets, exactly. So for the Davis data, the source material creates these buckets. For price, they just split it into two, low and high. And the cutoff is roughly $250,000. If you're under that, you're low. If you're over, you're high.
Simple enough. What about for size?
For size, they create three buckets: small, medium, and large. So now, instead of this long list of 29 specific numbers, we have a nice, neat grid, a matrix. The rows are price, the columns are size.
Okay, so I'm looking at this grid in my mind's eye. I see the top left cell, low price, and small size. There's a number in there, 11. What does that 11 represent?
That is the count of observations. It means that in our data set of 29 houses, there are exactly 11 houses that were classified as both small in size and low in price.
Okay. And if I look at the high price and large size cell, I see the number 6.
Right. Six houses were both expensive and large. And you also get totals on the sides and the bottom. We call them marginal totals. For example, the total number of low-price houses, regardless of their size, is 17.
Ah, okay. So 11 out of those 17 low-price houses are small.
See, you're already doing the analysis. Okay. You just calculated a row percentage. 11 divided by 17 is about 64.7%. So nearly two-thirds of the cheap houses are small. That's starting to tell a story.
It is.
But the real detective work in tabulation comes from comparing what we see to what we should see.
What we should see. You mean like if the world operated on pure chance?
Exactly. If the variables were independent. This is the concept of statistical independence. We ask ourselves this question. If house size had absolutely zero effect on price, if they were totally unrelated, how many houses would we expect to find in that low price, small size cell?
Okay, that's a hypothetical. It's a what if. How do we calculate a hypothetical?
It's just probability logic. We know that 17 out of the 29 houses are low price. That's the overall proportion.
Right.
And we know 13 out of the 29 houses are small. If these two things are totally separate events, like flipping two different coins, we just multiply the probabilities.
Can you walk me through the math for that specific cell?
Yep. You take the row total, which was 17 for low price houses. You multiply it by the column total, which was 13 for small houses. And then you divide by the grand total, which is 29 observations.
So 17 times 13 divided by 29. I'm punching that into my calculator and I get 7.62.
Right. So if price and size were completely unrelated, we would expect to see about 7 or maybe 8 houses in that corner of the table.
But we didn't see 7 or 8. We actually saw 11.
Exactly. We observed 11. We expected 7.6. That is a surplus. We have more small, cheap houses than random chance would predict. That gap, the difference between the observed and the expected, is your evidence. It's the signal that independence is false. Size and price are linked.
That's actually really clever. It turns what looks like a boring table into a kind of gotcha moment.
It does.
But tables are still, well, the tables, they're tabular. I'm a visual learner. I want to see the dots. I want to see the picture.
Then you want method two, the two-way scatter plot. This is the bread and butter of economics. It's probably the most common graph you'll see. You just draw a graph. The vertical axis is price, our yallers. The horizontal axis is size, our six toys.
When you just plot the points.
You take your 29 houses and you place a dot for each one. House number one was this big and cost this much. Put a dot there. House number two, put a dot there, all the way to 29.
And when we look at the graph for the Davis data, what do we see?
We see a swarm of bees, basically. But the swarm is moving. It's drifting upwards and to the right. As you move to the right on the graph, which means bigger size, the dots tend to move up, which means higher price.
So it confirms visually what the table just told us numerically.
It does. It's the first and most important visual check you should always do.
Okay, so the picture confirms the relationship. But up and to the right is a direction. It's not a measurement. I can't put up and to the right into a spreadsheet and do math with it. We need a number, a single number that tells us how strong this relationship is.
And now we are entering section two of our guide, measuring association. And for this, we need to talk about covariance and correlation.
Covariance, it sounds important. It sounds like a military operation, Operation Covariance.
It does, but it's just a measure of how two variables vary together, hence covariance.
Okay, so how do we calculate it? What's the logic?
The logic is all built on deviations from the mean. We look at every single data point, every house, and we ask two questions. How far is your size from the average size? And how far is your price from the average price?
So we have two differences, two deviations for every single house.
Correct. And to understand what we do next, it helps to visualize a quadrant. Imagine we draw a big crosshair right through the middle of the data. The vertical line is the average price and the horizontal line is the average size.
Okay, so I have four boxes.
Right. Now take a house in the top right box. What can you tell me about it?
It's bigger than average, and it's more expensive than average.
Exactly. So its size deviation is positive, and its price deviation is also positive. The formula tells us to multiply those two deviations together.
So a positive number times a positive number equals a positive number.
Correct. Now let's go to the bottom left box, a tiny little shack. What about that one?
It's smaller than average, so a negative size deviation, and it's cheaper than average, so a negative price deviation.
And what happens when you multiply those two together?
A negative times a negative is also positive. I see what's happening.
This is the brilliance of the formula. Whether you are a big, expensive house or a small, cheap house, you contribute a positive number to the total sum. You are reinforcing the trend. You are evidence for the up and to the right story.
But what about the oddballs, the weird ones? Like a small house that's inexplicably expensive? Maybe it's on a prime corner lot?
That would be in the top lift box. It would have a negative size deviation because it's small times a positive price deviation because it's expensive. That gives you a negative number.
So it subtracts from the total. It fights the trend.
It fights the trend. And the same for a big, cheap house that's falling apart. But since most of our houses in the Davis data follow the rule, the positives overwhelm the negatives.
And we sum up all those products. We do a little division by one and one another, and we get the sample covariance.
That's it.
Okay, I'm looking at the source material here. The covariance for the house data is, wow, 11,701,613.3.
11 million.
That is a huge number. Does that mean the relationship is super, super strong? Like, unbreakable?
We have absolutely no idea.
What do you mean it's 11 million?
But it's 11 million? What? The units are bizarre. They're square foot dollars. What on earth is a square foot dollar? It's a meaningless unit. If we had measured the price in cents instead of dollars, the number would be 100 times bigger.
Mm.
If we measured the house in square inches instead of square feet, the number would be astronomically huge. But the underlying relationship itself hasn't changed one bit.
I see. So covariance is sensitive to scale. It's not scale-free. It's messy.
It's very messy. It's an intermediate step. We need to clean it up. We need a number that strips away the units, the dollars, the feet, the inches, and just leaves the pure signal of the relationship. And that number is the sample correlation coefficient, usually denoted by a lowercase dollars.
So how do we get from that ugly 11 million to a clean, understandable dollars?
We standardize it. We take the covariance and we divide it by the standard deviation of a six, multiplied by the standard deviation of dollars. Essentially, we're dividing the square foot dollars by feet times dollars.
And the units cancel out.
Poof. They're gone. Mm. You are left with a pure, unitless number that is always strictly between negative one and positive one.
Where macus one is a perfect negative relationship, a straight line going down,
right.
And one is a perfect positive relationship, a straight line going up.
And zero is.
A cloud, a shapeless blob, no linear relationship whatsoever.
Exactly.
So for our Davis houses, after all that math, what's the number? What's the number?
The dollars is 0.786 cents.
Okay, 0.786. Now, that feels understandable. It's not one, so it's not a perfect straight line, but it's pretty close to one, so it's a strong positive correlation.
It is. It tells us that size and price are tightly linked.
Yeah.
They move together significantly. But it's not perfect. There's some noise in the data. There's variation. But the signal is loud and clear.
Okay. So we've established there is a relationship. We've visualized it with a scatter plot. We've measured its strength with correlation. But I'm still unsatisfied.
Why is that? 7786 is a great finding.
Because I can't use it. I can't do anything with correlation. If I tell a real estate agent the correlation is 0.786, they can't set a listing price with that information. I want a model. I want to be able to say, if you tell me your house is 2,000 square feet, I can predict the price will be X.
You want the crystal ball.
I want the crystal ball.
That brings us to section three. This is the heavy lifting. This is linear regression. We are going to draw that line through the swarm of bees.
The regression line. I see the equation. B1 plus B2 by less. It looks just like high school algebra, you know. OI1X plus B dollar.
It is exactly that, just with a slightly fancier notation.
Yeah.
You need the price. Yep. Six cells is the size. BD1 is the intercept, what you call B-thirst. And T-vitor is the slope, which you call the bobber. And that little hat on the Y, that just means it's our prediction.
Okay, but here's the problem. I look at that scatter plot, and I could draw 100 different lines through it. I could tilt it a little up, maybe a little down. How in the world do we choose the single best line? What's the rule?
We use a method called ordinary least squares, or OLS. And the philosophy behind it is actually quite fascinating. OLS is a pessimist.
A pessimist? How can a mathematical formula be a pessimist?
It focuses entirely on mistakes. For any line you might draw, OLS looks at the residuals. A residual is just the vertical distance between an actual data point and your line. It's the error.
So, like, the house actually sold for $300,000, but my line predicted $280,000. That $20,000 gap is the residual.
That's your residual.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to make those residuals, those mistakes, as small as possible. But there's a catch. Some residuals are positive. The dot is above the line. Some are negative. The dot is below. If you just add them all up, they might cancel each other out and sum to zero, even if your line is absolutely terrible.
Okay, so we have to make them all positive.
You have to make them all positive, so we square them.
We square them, hence least squares.
Exactly. But pause and think for a second about the implication of squaring.
Okay. If I make a small mistake, say my prediction is off by one. One squared is just one.
Right. We'll slap on the wrist. No big deal. Now imagine you make a big mistake. You're way off. Your prediction is off by 10.
10 squared is 100.
Exactly. The penalty didn't just go up by 10 times. It went up by 100 times. OLS is terrified of being really wrong about any single point. It would much rather have a bunch of small, acceptable errors than one giant outlier error.
So it forces the line to thread the needle right through the middle of the data to avoid those massive squared penalties.
That's the intuition. It is a penalty system that absolutely hates outliers.
Yeah.
And using calculus, which we will happily skip today for our listeners.
Thank you.
We can derive the exact formulas for the slope, degeneration, and the intercept that are guaranteed to minimize that total sum of squared penalties.
Okay, so let's skip the calculus and just look at the result. We run the regression on the house data. The computer, or the very diligent student with a calculator, spits out an equation. It says, predicted price equals 115,017 plus 73.77 times size.
And now we're in section 4. Interpretation. This is where so many students lose points on an exam. They can calculate the number, but they can't explain what it means in plain English.
So let's break it down. Let's start with the slope, 73.77.
The technical definition of the slope is the change in the predicted value of EI dollars for a one unit increase in 6.
Okay, translating that. If I add one single square foot to my house, the price is predicted to go up by $73.77.
Mathematically, yes. But think about that for a second. Does that feel intuitive? Who adds one square foot to a house? Honey, I've expanded the living room by 12 inches. It's a bit weird. It doesn't feel tangible.
It feels tiny. $73. That's a nice dinner out, not a real estate renovation.
This is why scaling your interpretation is so important and so powerful. Don't talk about one square foot. Talk about something real. Talk about a room. A small bedroom or an office might be, say, 10 feet by 10 feet.
That's 100 square feet.
Exactly. So what do you do with the slope?
I multiply it by 100. So 73.77 times 100 is $7,377.
Right. So now you can say, in this market, adding a 100 square foot room is associated with a price increase of about $7,400.
Now that clicks. I can visualize that value. That makes sense.
And notice you use the word associated. You didn't say causes. That's very good discipline.
I'm learning. Okay, now, what about the intercept? That's the other number, 115,017.
The intercept is the predicted value of EI when $6 is equal to 0. So taken literally, this means a house with 0 square feet costs $115,000.
That's ridiculous. A house with 0 square feet is a vacant lot, maybe.
Maybe. Or maybe it's just a philosophical concept. But in reality, it's a warning. It's a warning about extrapolation. Our data only includes houses between 1,400 and 3,300 square feet. We've never seen a 0 square foot house in our data. So extending the line all the way back to 0 is dangerous and probably misleading.
It's what you'd call out of sample.
It is. The intercept is often just a mechanical anchor that helps position the line correctly in the middle of the data. It's not always a meaningful real-world price tag. We should generally stick to predicting things that are in sample.
So if I want to predict the price of a 2,000 square foot house.
That's safe. That's right in the heart of our data. We just plug 2,000 into our equation for $6,115,017 plus 73.77 times 2,000.
And the calculator says $262,557.
Right. The source material rounds it to about $263,000. That is our fitted value, our best guess.
But if I tried to use the same formula for a 10,000 square foot mega mansion.
You're in trouble. You're extrapolating way beyond your data. The relationship might be totally different out there. Maybe for huge mansions, the price per square foot goes down because it's hard to find buyers. Or maybe it skyrockets because of luxury finishes. Our little linear model doesn't know. It's blind outside of its lane.
Okay, so we have a model. We have a prediction. But is it a good model? I mean, $73 a square foot seems reasonable, but does the model actually fit the data well? This brings us to section 5, measures of model fit.
And we have two main metrics here to discuss, the standard error of the regression and the one everyone knows, the 22 Ehlers.
Let's start with the less famous one, the standard error of the regression, or $7.
This is basically the typical size of our mistake. It measures the standard deviation of the residuals. It tells you, on average, how far off our predictions are from the actual sale prices.
Lower is better, obviously. A smaller average mistake is good.
Yes. But again, just like covariance, it suffers from a scale problem. It's measured in dollars. If the standard error is, say, $20,000, is that good or bad? On a $300,000 house, that seems pretty good. On a $50,000 car, that's a terrible model.
Right. It's relative. So we need a percentage. We need a standardized measure. We need the famous Tordo 2, the coefficient of determination.
This is the headline number. the explainability score. It always ranges from 0 to 1 or 0% to 100%.
I often hear definitions of tortured dollars, too, that sound like word salad. The proportion of the total variation in the dependent variable that is explained by the variation in the independent variable. Can we break that down? Maybe use the pie of mystery analogy.
I love the pie of mystery. Mm-hmm. Okay, imagine the total sum of squares is a giant pie. Mm-hmm. This pie represents all the variation in house prices in our data. Some houses are expensive, some are cheap, and we don't know why. It's just a big, confusing blob of mystery.
Got it. A big pie of mystery.
Then we introduce our explanatory variable, house size. Suddenly we look at the pie and we realize, oh, a lot of these houses are expensive because they're big, and a lot of them are cheap because they are small. We have explained a chunk of the mystery.
We took a slice out of the pie.
Exactly. The explained sum of squares is the slice of the pie that we successfully explained with our model. The $20, too, is simply the ratio of the slice we ate to the size of the whole pie.
Okay, so if the $20 for our house data is 0.6175.
It means we have successfully explained 61.75% of the total mystery, the total variation in house prices, just by looking at one variable size.
And what about the other 38%?
That's the residual sum of squares. Mm. That's the part of the pie we couldn't eat. It's the mystery that's left over. It represents everything else that affects price, the location, the age of the house, how nice the kitchen is, the school district, or just random luck.
That's actually a surprisingly intuitive way to think about it. So is 0.61 a good score? In school, 61% is a D minus.
Well, this isn't school. In physics, 0.61 would be terrible because gravity works pretty much perfectly every time. But in social sciences and economics, 0.61 is actually quite high. Human behavior and markets are incredibly noisy.
There's a really important nuance here about aggregation too, right? Students shouldn't panic if they get a low R-squared.
A huge nuance. Students often freak out when their regression on individual people gives them a low trial, like 0.1 or 10%. But think about the relationship between, say, years of education and annual earnings. If you look at individuals, the $20 too is going to be low.
Right, because my neighbor Bob has a PhD and is an unemployed artist, and my other neighbor Steve dropped out of college and invented a $1 billion app.
Exactly. Individual lives are incredibly noisy and random. But if you aggregate that data, if instead you plot the average earnings per state against the average education per state, all that individual noise starts to cancel out. The underlying relationship becomes clear, and the $20 too might jump up to 0.8 or even 0.9.
So a low 22.2 doesn't mean the relationship isn't real or important. It just means the individual level data is messy.
Correct. The slope, the economic return on an extra year of education, might be the exact same in both regressions, even if the 22 is wildly different. Never, ever judge a model solely by its 22.2.
Okay, we have been talking about the theory for a long time now. I think it's time to prove we can actually walk the walk. We are going to do a live calculation.
The study guide exercise.
I'm slightly terrified. You promised me we could do this on audio without a whiteboard or a screen.
We can. Listeners, if you are driving, please keep your eyes on the road. But try to visualize this with us. We are going to build a regression model from scratch with a tiny, tiny data set.
5 households. That's it. Our variables are one person, number of vehicles, and $6 sells household size, meaning the number of people.
Okay, try to visualize the 5 points on a graph.
One person, one car, the point.
Yeah. One, one.
2 people, 2 cars, the point, 2 cars.
3 people, 2 cars, the point, 3, 2.
4 people, 2 cars, the point, 4 and 2.
5 people, 3 cars, the point, 5, 3. Got it. It's a gentle upward slope. More people, generally more cars. Seems plausible.
Step 1, calculate the means, the averages. First, let's sum the number of people, the $6 values. 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 4 plus 5.
Okay, that's 15.
And we have 5 households, so we divide by 5.
The mean of $6 is 3.
Perfect. Now let's sum the number of cars, the dollar values.
Awesome.
So 1 plus 2 plus 2 plus 2 plus 3.
That's 10. We divide by 5, so the mean of your dollar is 2.
Excellent. We have our center of gravity for the data, the point, 3, 2. Now for step 2, calculate deviations and products. We need to see how far each point is from that center point. 3, 2. Let's take the first point. 1, 1. The $6 deviation is its x value, 1 minus the mean, 3.
So 1 minus 3 is negative to 2.
And the negative deviation is its a value, 1 minus the mean, 2.
1 minus 2 is negative 2.
Great. The formula for the slope's numerator says we multiply those two deviations. So minus 2 times minus 1.
That's a positive 2.
Good. Let's do the last point, 5, 3, to see the other side. What's the $6 deviation?
That's 5 minus the mean of 3, so positive 2.
And the negative deviation.
3 minus the mean of 2, positive 1.
And their product.
2 times 1 is 2.
The middle points are interesting. Take the point. 3, 2. It's $6 is 3. The mean of $6 is 3, so the deviation is 0.
So the product for that point is 0. It contributes nothing to the sum of the products.
Exactly. So if you do this for all 5 points and sum up all the products, you get 4. That is our numerator for the slope formula.
Numerator is 4. Got it. Now for the denominator. The formula says it's the sum of the squared x deviations. So for point 1, the x deviation was minus 2. Squared is 4.
Right.
For point 5, the deviation was 2. Squared is also 4. The middle point was 0. And points 2 and 4, their x values were 2 and 4. So they were each off by 1 from the mean of 3. 1 squared is just 1.
So you're summing up 4 plus 1 plus 0 plus 1 plus 4.
That's 10.
We are ready for step 4. Calculate the slope. It's the numerator divided by the denominator.
So 4 divided by 10, the slope, 2b22, is 0.4.
And the interpretation.
An extra person in the household is associated with 0.4 extra cars.
Spot on. Step 5, the intercept. The formula is a b-tobart. We have all those numbers.
Okay, the mean of Yeowers was 2, the slope is 0.4, and the mean of $6 was 3. So it's 2 minus 0.4 times 3. That's 2 minus 1.2. The intercept is 0.8.
So our final regression equation is... predicted number of vehicles equals 0.8 plus 0.4 times the number of people. We can even check it. For a household with one person, the model predicts 0.8 plus 0.4 times 1, which is 1.2 cars. The actual was one car. The residual is small, negative 0.2.
It actually works. We just did OLS in our heads. That is strangely satisfying.
It demystifies the black box, right? The computer is just doing exactly that, but with, you know, thousands of numbers instead of 5.
Okay, before we wrap this up, we have to cover the final section, section 7. Critical nuances and warnings. This is the fine print on the label. We've built the model, but how can we break it? Or how can we misinterpret it?
The first one is outliers. We mentioned OLS hates large squared errors. So if we had one household in our data with one person, but for some reason they had 100 cars.
A car collector.
That one point would be so far away from the line that its squared residual would be enormous. The OLS method would tilt the entire line fiercely towards that one point just to reduce that one huge penalty.
So outliers can act like a lever, pulling the whole line out of whack.
Exactly. Always, always check your scatter plot for outliers first.
Okay, second warning.
Fine.
Correlation does not imply causation. We say this until we are blue in the face in every statistics class.
But it's the most important one. The text uses a great example, the directionality problem. The data might show a positive correlation between alcohol consumption and depression. But does alcohol cause depression, or does depression lead people to consume more alcohol?
The math is identical either way. The regression line will look the same.
It looks the same, but the policy solution, the real-world implication, is totally different depending on which way the causal arrow points.
And then there's a third variable problem.
This is the infamous omitted variable bias. We see a strong positive link between years of education and lifetime earnings, but maybe there is a third ghost variable that we didn't measure, like innate drive or ambition. Maybe ambitious people are more likely to get more education and more likely to make more money.
So if we don't measure drive, we might accidentally give all the credit to the college degree when really it was the person's ambition all along.
Precisely.
Finally, there is a weird mathematical gotcha that I know always shows up on exams, reverse regression.
This one trips everyone up. Because correlation is symmetric, the correlation of 6 involvers is the same as the correlation of null and 6. People assume the regression line is reversible too.
Right. If I have an 80 is 2 pullers, then I can just rearrange it with algebra to say $6 implies Y dollars.
In algebra, yes. In statistics, no. Remember, when we regress price on size, OLS minimizes the vertical errors, the mistakes in price.
Okay.
If you swap them and regress size on price, the OLS procedure is now minimizing the horizontal errors, the mistakes in size.
Oh, right. We are optimizing for a completely different set of penalties. It's a different problem.
Fundamentally different problem. And it gives you a different line. In the house data, the slope of price on size was about 74. If you just inverted that number, 1 divided by 74, you'd get about 0.013. But if you actually run the reverse regression, the true slope is 0.008.
They're completely different numbers. That is a fantastic nuance. It really highlights that you need to know your theory, not just your algebra.
It highlights that in statistics, the independent and dependent variables are not interchangeable labels. You must know which direction your hypothesis flows.
So let's bring it all home. We started with a mission to summarize the relationship between two variables.
We went from raw lists of numbers to two-way tables, where we hunted for deviations from statistical independence. Then we visualized that relationship with the scatter plot.
We measure the pure strength of the association with correlation, solving the unit scale problem of covariance.
We modeled it with linear regression, using the pessimist's tool ordinary least squares to find the one single best fitting line.
And we learned to interpret that line turning a number like 73.77 into the price of an extra room. And then we checked our work with the pie of mystery that is 22.2.
And we even did the math ourselves, by hand.
The power of all these tools is really about moving from a vague intuition like, I reckon big houses cost more, to a precise statement like, I can tell you that an extra 100 square feet is associated with a price increase of exactly $7,400 in this market, and size explains about 62% of the price differences we see.
It's the move from intuition to science. It's quantification.
It is.
But I will leave you and our listeners with one final provocative thought. We just spent this entire deep dive assuming that the world works in straight lines. The core assumption of our model was linearity, but nature rarely moves in perfect straight lines.
What if the relationship curves? What if the price per square foot actually goes up even faster for huge mansions?
Then your straight line is the wrong tool for the job. You would need something more flexible, like non-parametric regression, or maybe adding polynomial terms. But that, my friend, is a story for chapter 6.
I cannot wait. Thanks for listening to this deep dive, and good luck with your study guide.